Deutsche Welle Spotlight on Europe.
Hello, welcome to our weekly program Spotlight on Europe, coming to you from our studios in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, the saga continues between Spain and Catalonia, but what effect could this have on the rest of Europe?
If this carries on, as we now suppose it will, then of course it has a destabilizing effect on the whole European Union. And so that is something that Europe is really afraid of, because it would completely fragmentize political decision making. And of course that would then really sort of stop the European Union in its tracks.
We will hear about the billionaire who could be the Czech Republic's new prime minister.
Like many countries in Europe and maybe in America, North America, of course, with the election of Trump, have witnessed the rise of populist sentiments.
Plus, why are the numbers of Protestants dwindling in the home of Protestantism in Germany? Stick around for these stories and more. I am Zipporah Nyambura. And we start off in Spain. Hopes for a possible solution to the Catalan independence crisis appear slimmer. The Spanish government this week activated an article in the constitution to impose direct rule on the northeastern state, a move which the Catalan leader, Carles Puigdemont, has termed Madrid's worst attack on Catalonia's institutions since General Franco's dictatorship. He's also accusing Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy of ignoring his calls for a dialogue. The question is, how will such a move affect the stability of Europe as a whole? Our correspondent Barbara Wessel has been following events from Brussels. She spoke to Emma Wallace.
If this carries on, I mean, at first it will have a destabilizing effect, of course, on Spain. We've seen that the growth expectations economically were downgraded. And it is sort of like a real test for Spanish democracy. And Madrid is not doing too well in that. I mean, there have been really mistakes being made on both sides, however. But if this carries on, as we now suppose it will, then, of course, it has a destabilizing effect on the whole European Union. Because we have to consider on the weekend the two richest regions in Italy, Veneto and Lombardy, had a referendum about wanting to pay less money to Rome. So we see that this is not a singular phenomenon. If we look at the map, one European newspaper last week did a funny thing and sort of created a map of Europe and sort of colored in all the little bits and patches that might want to be independent. And in the end, it looked like, a tablecloth made up of patchwork. I mean, it's just very colorful and very wild. And you end up with about 50 tiny little different states. Because if we look at Spain, you have the Basque country. If you look at, of course, Great Britain, you still have Scotland. I mean, that's been settled, but maybe not forever. You have Wales. You now have the Ireland question. Wherever you look, there are regions that would like to sort of go it alone. And so that is something that Europe is really afraid of, because it would completely fragmentize political decision making. And of course, that would then really sort of stop the European Union in its tracks.
Do you think that everyone in Brussels agrees with this tack to sort of ignore what's going on in Spain and Catalonia for the moment? Or do you think there are some people that think that Europe itself and the EU needs to rethink this idea of nation states and start looking more at smaller regional identities?
We have a legal problem here, and that is a very basic problem. That is that the European Union is made up of a number of nation states, the number exactly of its member states, still 28 in a year and a half's time to be 27. And the treaties, that is the contracts between those member states, have been made with the capitals, more or less, the central governments of these states, and not with regions. I mean, look at Germany. It's a federal state. It has a number of regions. If now the Bavarians would jump up and say, oh, we would like to be our own state, and so on and so forth, there could be no end to this. It's a significant problem for the European Union, because legally it cannot really do something. Because if you say a Europe of regions, I mean, that doesn't exist. Of course, they have even a representation here. They are being heard. They can come here. They can talk here. Catalonia has a representation situation here in Brussels and so on and so forth. But they are not, in that sense, sort of contract partners of Europe. And that is the central point.
Despite the law, though, do you think that there are some people in Brussels that are starting to think that the way that the European Union was set up, with this idea of keeping peace within Europe, with this idea of the very strong nation state as the only way to keep peace and to keep solidarity, do you think that there are some people now who are starting to think, hey, Europe is anyway a collection of lots of different states and cultures, so why not diversify, fragment a little bit more and keep it all together that way?
Nobody who has any say here or who is connected to European government says that. I mean, you do have some messages like that on the left in the European Parliament, for instance. But that's pretty much the only ones, because everybody else knows that it would become completely unworkable. It is very difficult to find agreement among 27 relatively well-organized member states. If you sort of double the number and think about having the same number or triple the number and say, oh, you have all the regions and they all come together here to a summit and then try to make a decision on the tax base, I mean, forget it. And everybody knows that. That would be the end of Europe as we know it. It would be a completely different structure and thing, something that cannot really factually, I mean, it seems like a nice idea, but factually it can't work. However, I mean, they did try to, everybody knows these regions exist in Europe. They know their different traditions and different cultures, and everybody always stresses the value of diversity. And people are absolutely not prohibited from sort of working with the European Union and sort of having their voices heard. Apart from that, the next step to fragmentize the whole thing and then to patch it together was like 50, 60, 70 tiny little states, not in the 21st century, not in a globalized economy.
Inside Europe's correspondent in Brussels, Barbara Wessel. As she mentioned, there are two wealthy regions in Italy voted last Sunday in a non-binding referendum to gain more control over their own regional affairs. This seems to be a growing trend worldwide, from Cameroon's English-speaking regions to Nigeria's Biafra state. More and more regions are calling for autonomy. But as Megan Williams reports from Rome, the Italian regions might be distancing themselves from separatists in Spain. But nevertheless, their votes reflect an emerging trend across Europe.
There was a time when across northern Italy, feverish rallies like this one called for the founding of a new nation called Padania.
La testa della nazione padana a Venezia, il governo.
Supporters of the separate state waved clover green flags and decried the waste of Rome. They held processions with water from the Po River and handed out Padanian ID cards and Bank of the North currency.
Il 15 settembre prenderà forma la colonna dorsale, la spina dorsale della nazione padana, il Po.
Flash forward 20 years, and the separatist aspirations, fueled by the Lega Nord, or Northern League Party, seem to have been carried away down the river. Instead, this week, in two legal, non-binding referendums held by the Lega Nord in the regions of Lombardy and Veneto, the question put to voters was not did they want to separate from Italy, but did they want to give permission to their regional leaders to negotiate with Rome for a little more autonomy. The day before the vote, Lombardy President Roberto Maroni was careful to distance himself from the Catalonian vote. He said the separatists there had lost their chance and gloated about the possibility of Milan now being in prime position to win a bid over Barcelona for the headquarters of the European Medicines Agency, poised to leave England after Brexit. In the Italian referendums, some 5 million people voted. More than 95% of them, almost 40% of the population in Lombardy and 60% in Veneto, said yes to more autonomy. The president of Veneto, the region surrounding Venice, declared the victory was nothing short of a big bang in Italian politics. Luca Zaia announced his region would ask for more administrative control and seek to keep 90% of its tax revenue.
But I don't think that in the end what the people will say is going to have a weight on the central decision-making that has to take place in order for their claims to be knowledge in practice. So I'm not sure that with the approval of those questions, something will really change in the competence that those regions have, because it's the national parliament that will decide in the end.
Politics expert Cristina Fuzone at Rome's Lewis University says, despite the post-referendum victory cries, the Italian regions may find a central government less amenable than they hope. She says in recent years, the main roadblock for regional independence has been the financial crisis that has gripped Europe and is still impacting Spain and Italy.
The main issue in both cases, Italian and the Spanish case, is that for a long time, the claims of region have been disregarded at the central level. Also for reasons depending on the financial crisis, because there was a moment in which Italy received financial support by the ECB. Spain even received financial assistance and financial support. So they had some fiscal constraints that they could not avoid.
Fuzone says with EU-propelled austerity measures brought in after the financial crisis in 2011, that was to bring down Italy's soaring debt, the financial hands of Italy and its regions have been tied. Still, a majority of people in Lombardy and some 40% in Veneto didn't even vote. People like Veneto Democratic Party activist Lorenzo Colovini. He says the vagueness of the referendum question, giving leaders permission to negotiate with Rome, was alarming to him.
It's like a check signed without any amount, okay?
Colovini says the referendum was really just a way for the Lega Nord to better position itself ahead of upcoming national elections. The Lega wants to increase its power in the center-right coalition headed by former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, now making a comeback.
The referendum is sort of propaganda for free for the governor.
But political observers say the strong backing of the referendum among those who voted shows just how well supported the populist party is in northern Italy, where it has a proven track record of responsible government, in contrast to much of the south of Italy.
There is still a gap of development in a way of possibility to get a job between the north and the south.
But legal expert and former cabinet minister Enzo Mauvero Milanese says if negotiations for control over their regional affairs prove successful with Rome, it could have a domino effect.
By the way, there were strong rumors about other regions seeking regional autonomy. So the mosaic is quite colored.
Megan Williams, DW Radio, Rome.
Janami tungane twache kuzozana.
Staying on the subject of politics, we head to the Czech Republic, to the man who is most likely to become the country's next prime minister. The man I am talking about is billionaire businessman Andrej Babiš. He is a former finance minister who is firmly against adopting the euro. He is said to be assertive, gets by on very little sleep, and promises to run the country like his massively profitable business. Sounds familiar? Yes, he has been compared to US President Donald Trump, but my colleague in Prague, Rob Cameron, says we should wait and see.
Andrej Babiš, the presumed next prime minister of the Czech Republic, speaking to reporters outside the gates of Lani Chateau, the out-of-town residence of the Czech president. Mr. Babiš emerged from his meeting with President Miloš Zeman to confirm that he would indeed be leading talks to form the next government, despite the many obstacles in his path.
I think my opinion on this is well known by now, that the biggest problem in our politics regarding effectiveness and reaching our goals are coalition governments. Unfortunately, we don't have a majority system like they do in the United States. I think that would be a far more suitable system because there's greater responsibility and clear results. The division of seats in parliament is clear, and from my own experience, I know that the fewer parties in a coalition, the better.
While Mr. Babiš's victory was a convincing one, With just under 30% of the vote, he gains 78 seats in the 200-seat lower house. The Slovak-born billionaire still has his work cut out forming a coalition. No one wants to go into government with him. Meanwhile, he's still formally charged with fraudulently obtaining EU funds for his luxury Stork's Nest resort outside Prague. Charges, he says, are politically motivated. President Zeman, a political ally, has said he would appoint Mr. Babiš prime minister even if he were in prison. There's no risk of that for now. The prosecution has been suspended, pending a new vote on lifting his parliamentary immunity.
Právě začaly povolební události České televize. Vítáme vás ze střechy Pražského Rudolfína.
Ano, krásný dobrý večer.
Voliči tady on the roof of a 1920s palace, built by Václav Havel's grandfather, the embattled remnants of Prague's liberal elite watched with dismay as the results came in. A strong showing for anti-system, anti-immigration and Eurosceptic parties, and a splintering of centre-left and centre-right pro-establishment politics. They're worried about the fate of Czech liberal democracy if Andrej Babiš turns to the far right or far left for tacit support. Journalist Petr Brod gave me his reading of the election results.
They tell us, I think, that like many countries in Europe and maybe in America, North America, of course, with the election of Trump, have witnessed the rise of populist sentiments, of nationalist sentiments, not necessarily nationalists to their neighbors, but being nationalist vis-a-vis the influx of immigrants from outside Europe. And that apparently the migration, which has been made into a big theme in this pre-election campaign in the Czech Republic, although the real figures tell us that the Czech Republic is not target of a mass movement of immigrants, has been wisely chosen by the populist parties, if only to gain votes.
Andrej Babiš has sought to reassure critics, especially foreign journalists, on just where he stands. His party is centrist, pro-European, he says. Certainly he is no threat to democracy. But he also remains opposed to euro adoption, is firmly against EU migrant quotas, and wants to lift sanctions against Moscow because they're bad for business. He suggested abolishing the upper house and streamlining the lower, and has described cabinet meetings as a talking shop. If he is appointed, Andrej Babiš will be a very different prime minister. Rob Cameron, DW, Prague.
This year we have witnessed governments clamping down on journalists critical of the government. In Cameroon, a journalist called Ahmed Abar was sentenced to 10 years in prison on terrorism charges. In Europe, Hungary is no exception. Prime Minister Viktor Orbán seems to have decided to step up his campaign against critical journalists ahead of the elections in April 2018. Our reporter in Hungary, Stefan Boss, has also found himself recently in the line of fire. He updated Emma Wallis on the situation at the moment.
This campaign, this specific campaign involving lists and so on, has begun recently. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán mentioned the press during a long speech during the commemoration of Hungary's 1956 revolution against Soviet domination. He used that occasion to speak about many things, and also obviously he mentioned the press.
Just a week ago in Malta, a journalist was murdered, apparently because of her work. Are journalists similarly worried in Hungary?
Yes, actually, they are worried. I know at least of one person. She told me that she has been threatened already, that she's afraid to go out at night. She was also one of the journalists on that list. I have to say that the atmosphere really started to change. Even myself, I've received messages, one of them saying that my family should have been sent on a holiday to Auschwitz, that I should never have been born, and this kind of things. Now, obviously, the rhetoric can be quite harsh. And people in the opposition are saying that there seems to be very little space for genuine criticism towards the government.
Are journalists like you finding it difficult to actually do your work? Are you being stopped, for instance, taken off press lists, not given access to the kinds of people that you need to speak to?
Indeed, that is a growing problem. Not long ago, my accreditation at the Foreign Ministry was taken away. They said that I have to reapply again. I also have received a letter from the media authority and the local authorities that I can no longer do broadcasts and also online activities from my current address. So more or less what I'm doing is illegal, you can say. But yes, things start to change. And I think it's part of a wider effort of intimidation towards journalists. And that is really what not only me, but also several correspondents I've spoken to, and especially also Hungarian journalists, are saying. So the atmosphere really starts to change towards the press.
Is there anything being done to combat Viktor Orban's campaign?
Absolutely. The Swedish ambassador was even organizing what he called a blacklist lunch at his residency here in Budapest. There were also ambassadors from France, Canada and other nations there. And among the diplomats was also the U.S. Charge d'Affaires, currently the top U.S. diplomat, David Kostolanczyk. And he earlier spoke at a meeting of the Hungarian Journalist Association, where he expressed concern about the way the Hungarian government is treating the press.
In a recent development, some media outlets closely linked to the government published the names of individual journalists they characterized as threats to Hungary. This is dangerous to the individuals and also to the principles of a free, independent media. We must protect free press.
The U.S. Charge d'Affaires ending that interview with Stefan Boss in Hungary. Is a special year here in Germany. The country will be marking the 500th anniversary of the so-called Reformation. The Reformation was spearheaded by a Catholic priest called Martin Luther. Luther published his famous 95 Theses, in which he heavily criticized the Catholic Church. Legend has it that he nailed his 95 Theses on the door of the All Saints Church in Wittenberg's town center. After being expelled from the Catholic Church, Luther became the founding father of the Protestant Christian movement. The number of Protestants has since risen to 800 million around the world. But in his hometown, the birthplace of the Protestant movement, the numbers are shrinking. Daniel Pels reports from Wittenberg.
Inside Wittenberg's famous St. Mary's Church, it does not look like the Protestant Church in Germany is in crisis. Some 70 people have come here to attend the midday prayer. They sit on the wooden benches, sing a hymn, and read the psalm from the Bible. Most of the faithful are tourists, though. It's not hard to distinguish them from locals. Almost all of them wear outdoor jackets and sport shoes. Camera bags and city maps are lying next to them. St. Mary's Church is one of the most important places for tourists in Wittenberg. It's where Martin Luther used to preach. The first Protestant service in Germany was also celebrated here. The church proudly calls itself the Mother Church of the Reformation. Wittenberg's Market Square is just a short walk from the church. Some tourist groups are standing on the cobblestoned pavement. Rain is pouring down from the grey autumn sky. A big black statue of a rather grim-looking Martin Luther, his hands clutching a Bible, is standing in the middle of the square. Herbert Schicke is selling beer at a small stand a few meters away.
Glauben sollte jeder Mensch an irgendwas. Der eine glaubt an Geld, der andere an Gott.
Every human being should believe in something. Some people believe in God, others believe in money. But when beliefs become a religion, things become dangerous and dogmatic. That's why I'm not particularly fond of the Catholic or the Protestant Church. I'm a pagan in the classic sense of the word.
Most of Wittenberg's approximately 48,500 residents would probably agree. Only about 12% of the population are Christian, although this city was once the birthplace of the Reformation. Here Martin Luther published his famous 95 Theses, which criticized Catholic teachings. The city is hosting a special exhibition to celebrate its famous son. But today, only a few people are strolling by and stop to watch a documentary about Luther's life. Many artifacts, such as Martin Luther's robe, his last will, or the remnants of his pulpit, are also on display. The exhibition has been curated by Protestant theologian Benjamin Haselhorn, who has also just published a book called The End of Lutherism.
In meiner Generation, ich bin jetzt 31 Jahre alt, kenne ich kaum jemanden, der regelmäßig in die Kirche geht.
I'm 31 years old and I hardly know anyone who regularly goes to church. But I know many people who have left the church. Once our parents and grandparents die, I really don't know who'll be left to form a congregation. If things continue the way they are, the Protestant Church will be a very small group in the future.
In 1990, almost 38% of Germans were Protestants. Now, only about 27% are still members of a Protestant church. More than 8 million people have either died or left the Protestant church since 1990. That also means that the church has lost a lot of income. In Germany, every registered church member has to pay a mandatory contribution to his or her church. It's automatically deducted from the salary of every working person and passed on to the respective church by the income tax department. So fewer members means less money. Johannes Block, pastor of St. Mary's, says he can already feel the effects.
Im Moment sehr massiv, weil eine Kollegin sich wegbewegt.
We're experiencing the impact of that quite strongly at the moment, because one of my colleagues has left and will have to continue with only two pastors. The number of full-time employees is going to increasingly decline in the future. Church members will have to rediscover the principle of universal priesthood. They'll have to live their faith with fewer full-time employees and pastors.
For centuries, Christians in Germany often had to walk only a few minutes to reach their church and find their pastor. But that is changing. Across Germany, church authorities have closed churches and merged local congregations. The number of pastors is also expected to shrink. The two pastors in Wittenberg, for example, do not just take care of St. Mary's Church. They also cater for several other churches. In all, their parish has around 3,800 members. But Reverend Johannes Block believes that the most radical changes are yet to come.
Ich glaube, dass die Kirche sich mehr und mehr zu Hausgemeinden entwickeln wird, dass es wenige kirchliche Zentren.
I think that the church is going to develop more into home-based congregations. I assume that there will be fewer religious centers. The faithful will gather around local ministers or bishops. We'll be fewer in number, but I think we'll be more relevant and maybe a little more cheerful, because we'll be able to let go of many worries and duties.
The rain has stopped and many tourists are now flocking to the market square. The Protestant church in Wittenberg does a lot to reach out to them and to the locals too. It runs different choirs, bands, youth and children's groups, a women's group and much more. The congregation also tries to attract the residents with concerts, public parties and other activities. But it seems that the days when this city and many others were mainly Protestant are gone forever. Daniel Pelz, DW, Wittenberg.
And that is all we had for you today. Thank you for listening. Remember, we would love to hear your response in an email via feedback.africa@dw.com. You can also find us on Facebook on DW Africa. Thanks to the rest of the team, Emma Wallis and our technician, Jörg Morawitz. We will be back next week with another edition of Spotlight on Europe. My name is Ipora Nyambura from all of us here at Deutsche Welle. Have a wonderful week ahead. Thank you.